So we're going to start off with a poem called Betty. Betty. In between jobs on a Monday afternoon, stop home for a sandwich before the next shift. My mom follows me into a bedroom to tell me that my grandfather has died. A massive heart attack overnight, and he never saw it coming. He never felt a thing. He just went to sleep and never woke up. And I'm not shocked or surprised. He was 70-something and a large man. We were never exceptionally close. Sometimes we lack emotions to be brave. Sometimes we lack emotions when we haven't made something real. And I decide to head to my other job, because what else could I do? I can talk to the manager there, take my bereavement leave starting tomorrow, but the job I just got off, I decide to call in between bites of a sandwich, forgetting that the boss, Sam, is on vacation. Instead, Betty answers the phone. Betty is Sam's assistant, and I tell Betty my grandfather has passed away and I won't be able to come in on Wednesday. I'll be back for my shift on Friday. Betty scoffs into the phone, and Betty tells me that I can't call off. Betty is 65. Betty's husband passed away 2 months ago. Betty got 2 weeks off, flowers for the funeral, and nobody said anything to Betty when, overwhelmed, she had to go to the back room to collect herself. That same Betty tells me that showing up to work on Wednesday, taking meat wrapped in juice and plastic out of boxes, then putting meat in a cooler is more important than being a pallbearer at my grandfather's funeral. Betty is a good American. She forgets the kindness other people show. It's a matter of what have you done for me lately? And I tell Betty that no matter what, I won't be in on Wednesday. If she has a problem with that, she should call Sam and we'll deal with it on Friday. I politely hang up the phone, somehow still not angry. But it dawns on me as receiver cradles, what a bitch Betty is. How inappropriate Betty's behavior is, and I wonder how I should handle Betty, Sam, and this shitty fucking job I hate anyway. Days pass and I carry my grandfather's casket. I struggle uphill Uniondale Cemetery and I continue to be brave, to not acknowledge reality until my uncle, my grandfather's son, breaks down as they lower the casket. And then I break down. And we all howl, wild dogs full of human grief. Friday morning comes, and I drive to work, still considering how to handle Betty, and by proxy, Sam. And I get to work on time, and I sit in the car for 10 minutes to make sure that I'm late. I close my eyes, and I let the anger come, not that I needed any help being pissed off at 20. I walk towards the back room, and as I'm about to hit the door, Sam shoots through and he says, "Oh, thank God you're here." And I say, "Fuck you, I'm not." He looks confused as I toss a smock and a name badge at him and turn for the front door, and he trails as I walk and he stammers, sad that he will unpack meat wrapped in juice and plastic out of cardboard boxes and then place them in coolers. As I reach the door, Sam yells, "Stop!" Desperation move. A former lover's plea. "Can I ask why?" I say, "Ask Betty." Does that set the tone, Stephanie? First time I had drinks with Stephanie, she told me she liked reading first, that she liked setting the tone. I think that set the tone. Hey, there's John and Pam. Hey, guys. All right, this next poem is called TB at the End of the Century. In a tuberculosis ward at the end of the 20th century, in a hospital at the beginning of the same century, through dusty windows, looking at a city that crumbles. A hospital gown and socks, room to room between tests for a job and a factory. Not in the army, but a soldier, all the same. Rust Belt veteran, armed in metal husk hills, a union job at the end of the manufacturing era. Physical first, cough, then piss in a cup. Cut some hair in case the piss cup lies. Breathe into a tube to make sure that my lungs work. In the tuberculosis ward that isn't any war, my lungs still work. I can breathe. I have healthy tissue, which ensures that I can get a job where they spray fiberglass fibers in the air. And if you don't wear a mask, those fibers stick inside your lungs, making healthy tissue inert. The fiberglass cuts down cilia trees that bleed, that scar, that freeze lungs, that suffocate you, but at least not in your own blood. By the way, there's wine in the back. Have some wine. Relax. I feel like everybody's not sure of themselves yet tonight. It's all good. Just be happy. You're here. It's a poetry reading. We're having fun. I swear we are. You can clap whenever you want. You can exhort. You can howl. You can say, "Oh shit, brother, that fucking sucks." Whenever you like. It would be fine with me. The other readers might feel differently. You'll have to gauge them. Oh shit, I'm sorry. This next poem, Steve Pellegrino actually told me this story. This is about working on Carrie Furness. But I'm not going to send it out to him. I'm going to send it out to his wife, who's a computer programmer and has to go to fucking work tonight at 11 o'clock. The abuses are myriad, right? Anyway, this is called The Belly of Hell. Yesterday's clothes, still wet with sweat, hang limp in a locker. Today's clothes, street clothes, freedom's clothes come off and lay on a bench vacant, socks on cold concrete, slowly, clammy, thermal underwear, jeans and flame-retardant pants, then thermal shirt, long-sleeve shirt, then flame-retardant coat, helmet under arm, rubber boots squeak off tile floor, already sweating as the locker room door opens. The storms of a graphite buzz in the air, climbing the cracks, irritating whatever exposed skin, the weather of a 10-hour night. The belly of hell awaits. I'm going over here, back to this book. Read one more from this. This is called To Change. It's New Year's Eve on the couch, and we drink delirium as the ball drops, and she says, "To a year of change." And I raise my glass and say cheers, and we kiss and make our way to bed. 2 days later, on time, and my district manager is there to meet me at the back door. She smokes and jitters in the cold and says, "We need to talk." And I follow her into the office, and I can hear the grimness as she says, "I don't have a significant enough sales increase. She has to let me go." I nod. It's bullshit, but I nod. And I walk up front and collect whatever is lying around, and she reminds me of a bottle I kept in the basement. I know Bobby and Amy are right there. No, they're not? Okay. Well, I'm fucking imagining things. Oh, they went that way. Threw me off. All right, and she reminds me of a bottle I kept in the basement. Just start right back up. I tell her I don't keep a bottle. She doesn't believe me, but I can take the high road. We, as a store, finished the bottle Christmas Eve. We got drunk and sold the walls bare, all of us happy that if we had to work on a holiday, at least we could be drunk and work together. And I go home, and I call my girlfriend, and I say, "Your toast is come true." She says, "Maybe this is a good thing." I say, "Maybe this is a good thing." Neither of us were prepared for how true her toast would become. I got two more for you, and then I'll randomly pick a reader out of the hat. Because I didn't tell anybody when they were reading. Nobody could make a decision. That's what writers do. I know, someone scoffed, and they were right to scoff. This is the winter of office supplies. It had been a hell of a few months, all culminating in this moment, carrying a couch into a new apartment. And I hate to stop this, but I have to take this call. I tell the guy on the other arm to take a break, dig the phone out of my pocket, and bark an unfriendly hello. I take a seat, half a couch on my lap. After 5 years together, I decided to leave. It was mid-November. Another argument escalating. She had taken to throwing punches now. I blocked or ducked or just let her hit my chest. They weren't aimed with much intent, but they were aimed. and then I'd hold her until she got tired and collapsed. Neither of us would have much to say. I knew about her rage, and I knew what renewed it. I knew it wasn't me. I was only the embodiment. I had tried to get through it, but I knew I wasn't helping. I was losing patience. And I was about to sign a lease when she called and pleaded and took me to dinner. To apologies, these dinners had become so frequent. We talked it out, and eventually she got me to agree to stay. Then the new year appeared, and I lost my job. I spent January taking a break, February looking for work, and with March came illness. I fought through upper respiratory infections, ear infections, cold flu, and not being right. No insurance, no doctor, a litany of interviews, and eventually, smuggled antibiotics. Stolen, sort of, from a vet hospital. At least they weren't the beef chewable kind. And it was then she asked me to leave. Although I could stay if I found an apartment, or when I found an apartment, or a job. The next months were spent getting lost, trying to stay out of the house, fielding angry phone calls while I try and avoid all the shit and psychic debris that comes at the end of a relationship. Her being suspicious as I spent long nights with friends who were trying to make sure I was okay. Then she would call and I'd have to talk her down. I couldn't refuse. I still theoretically needed a place to live. Finally, Memorial Day weekend, the Holy Grail, 6 interviews in one day, and I rushed each of them, pulling charm from the deep, all the while my mother scouted apartments for me. You know you're fucked when your mother starts scouting apartments for you. And I took whichever one. The landlord didn't check references. I called an old district manager just in case someone needed to lie for me. Then I convinced the landlord to let me pay a security deposit late, and it all led me here. 6 potential jobs, and I listed them 1 through 6 in my head, and here I am with a couch on my lap and a phone call from choice number 6. Who isn't offended when I bark an unfriendly hello, rasp and sweat into a phone as he offers me a job that I accept, hoping to hell that another one of these companies call back? They don't. The winter of office supplies had begun. Adam Macho made this poem happen. He said something at a Hemingway's reading that made this come through my head like a lightning bolt. So this is for him, and this is the last poem I'm going to read before I announce the next reader, whoever that may be. This is called The Hymn to Thrift Store Ties. God, I needed a fucking job. I was working as a third key at an office supply store, and it wasn't what I wanted, but I was desperate. I took it and I spent the next year going on an interview a week hoping for resurrection. I'd gotten a call from a bookstore that I'd been hired at 3 times before, but timing had always required me to decline. Another job on the ladder, another path that paid better. This time would be different. This was to change my luck, and I could feel my luck change. And I felt good. I thought I should wear a tie today. Anybody want to pass out? We'll just toss you in the fucking... Yeah. Can we proceed? I think we can. I could feel my luck change. And I felt good. I thought, I should wear a tie today. I didn't have a decent tie, so I stopped at a thrift store in Sharpsburg, and I picked a dandy off the 50-cent rack. Risking being late to look proper, my donation a prayer to St. Vincent de Paul, whomever the fuck that is. And I arrived, assured of myself as the interview started, and the manager and I quickly dismantled questions for talk. I was charming. I was exhibiting my wit and my ease with people. I was exemplary. I would be a model employee. And he compliments me on my tie and being consistently overly honest to the point of being blunt. I tell him I picked it up at the thrift store on the way here. He compliments me on my taste. He says maybe he should buy his ties in thrift stores. Black Friday was just a few days away, and as we completed our dalliance, the manager tips his hand. He says, we need a magazine manager, and I think you would be perfect. Call me on Monday. We'll get this shit started. And I was on the air. The salt mines of office supply were soon to be shuttered. The holidays ahead, I could be easy. I could relax. I could enjoy what could be a stay of execution in so many ways. and Monday is green grass in November, and I shake off sleep, anxious for the telephone. I call and get the runaround. The manager isn't around. Call in tomorrow. Now, I'm unsure. As the days pass, I am religious, calling dutifully, still not convinced that I've been jilted. Wednesday, and I finally get someone to answer that the manager had been fired the day after the interview. They would not be honoring his last hire. Thanks, folks.